Chapter 3. Swift Ascent. The essential ingredient of politics is timing. Pierre Elliott Trudeau.
More than anything else, it is the leader who makes the difference. J. Edward Ned Beliveau, 1966 election strategy, PEI Liberal Party.
Alex Campbell had no time to rest following his by-election victory. The Prince Edward Island legislature opened 9 days later. Campbell says that he was bemused and befuddled, a neophyte in a rather strange environment. The main activity in the legislature was verbal sparring between opposition leader Alex Matheson and Premier Walter Shaw. Shaw wasn't showing his 77 years and gave every indication that he planned to be around for a while. Former Premier Matheson, while 15 years Shaw's junior, was marking time as Liberal leader after losing elections in 1959 and 1962. Campbell says that he was somewhat amused by the antics that went on and found the exchanges between Shaw and Matheson to be mainly malevolent and malicious and very personal, and the opposition Liberals to be disorganized, divided, and dispirited. Campbell devoted himself to learning the procedures of the legislature and to honing his speaking abilities. The 31-year-old MLA had gained some experience making arguments in court as a fledgling lawyer, including the occasional jury trial, at one of which he successfully defended a young man charged with murdering his father. However, he found that these skills were not readily transferable to a real live audience in the political arena. Campbell's first major address came on March 2, 1965, when he spoke for 45 minutes during the debate in response to the speech from the throne. He touched on education, agriculture, the fishery, industrial development, and other matters. Many years later, Campbell would laugh about his earnestly delivered speeches in the 1965 legislative session, recalling that he had a lot to learn about addressing a live and critical audience. Less than a month after Campbell took his seat in the legislature, Liberal leader Alex Matheson announced to a stunned audience of student Liberals at St. Dunstan's University that he was stepping down. This came as a surprise to his caucus colleagues and to party officials. The caucus moved right away to name Dr. Lorne Bunnell as interim leader, going against Matheson's wishes to remain until a new leader was chosen. With the prospect of an election to take place in 1966, the opposition Liberals wanted a change. The party executive scheduled a convention for the fall of 1965, but when a federal election was called for November 8th, the convention was postponed to December 11th.
The Leadership Contest.
Interim leader Lorne Bunnell was undecided or cagey about whether he would seek the permanent leadership, but most everyone assumed that he would. Alex Campbell was visited by several delegations urging him to run, the most prominent and persistent being a trio of Charlottetown businessman Sid Green, lawyer Jack Nicholson, and insurance broker George Buss Peak. They felt the party needed fresh blood and liked what they had seen in the young MLA. Whatever risks they saw in Campbell's youth or inexperience were overridden by Thane Campbell's reputation as Chief Justice and former Premier. Many of the early predictions about Alex Campbell were based in conventional like-father-like-son thinking. Campbell initially rebuffed the entreaties, as he felt that he had a lot to learn about public life, plus he had a young family and a fledgling law practice. Further, Campbell said, "I had absolutely no confidence in myself as a public speaker." He continued to be visited by delegations and individuals who argued that the party needed youthful leadership. Prince County was strongly behind him, and there was substantial support from elsewhere in the province. The matter came to a head after a late-night meeting in Jack Nicholson's law office in Charlottetown, when a group of leading Liberals worked to persuade Campbell. He told them that he would give them an answer within 24 hours. After consulting with his family, he agreed the next day to become a candidate for the leadership. Asked almost 50 years later about that decision, Marilyn Campbell reflects, "I was so naive, I probably had no idea what it entailed. But you do what you have to do. I don't think I ever thought negatively about it." Campbell soon discovered that his campaign had already been started, as the process of urging him to run had built up a considerable network within party ranks. He took to the road, visiting as many poll captains as possible and writing to delegates. There would be 5 from each polling district. This was an intensive effort in the space of a few weeks. As late as December 2nd, 9 days before the convention, Lorne Bunnell was still undecided about whether he would seek the leadership. Campbell was beginning to get the sense that he might just win. To put him more at ease with the meet-and-greet requirements of political campaigning and to give him exposure, Campbell's supporters placed him at Charlottetown's main pedestrian intersection, known as Hughes's Corner, to introduce himself and shake hands with the pre-Christmas passers-by. While Campbell started out characteristically reserved, he soon got the hang of it and wanted to stay longer to meet more people. The convention took place on December 11th at the Confederation Center of the Arts. There were 1,000 delegates crammed into the main auditorium and another 300 in the foyers watching on closed-circuit television. Campbell stood near the main entrance and shook hands with arriving delegates. He recalled later that this was his first experience of having what he called a wounded arm as a result of so much handshaking. Bunnell delivered a strong speech. Campbell was earnest and reserved in telling delegates that the situation in the province has reached a critical point. He drew attention to what he called the mounting debt and departmental irresponsibilities of the present government. Campbell self-consciously thumped the podium for emphasis at designated points in his carefully read address. Unbeknownst to Campbell at the time, a handful of his more seasoned supporters, led by Cecil Miller, were strategically distributed throughout the audience to lead an enthusiastic response each time Campbell thumped the podium. 40 years later, Campbell would look back on the event and comment wryly, "Heaven knows I needed it then." The primary focus of Campbell's speech was on the party itself, promising a reactivation of the Prince Edward Island Liberal Association. He undertook to visit every district with a view to help the local organizations get the best qualified candidates and to get them elected. He promised to engage the party membership in a policy process, to place new emphasis on party finances, and to keep the Young Liberals organization active, not just at election time. The underlying promise of Campbell's candidacy was of youth and renewal. When the voting results were announced by Convention Chair Elmer Blanchard, Campbell had the support of 765 delegates to 592 for Lorne Bunnell. Bunnell rushed to the microphone and raised Campbell's arm as he moved that the decision be made unanimous. Nova Scotia Liberal leader Gerald Regan, who was guest speaker at the convention, offered a closing challenge to the delegates, proposing a race with Nova Scotia Liberals to see which of us can regain power first. Seasoned political commentator Hartwell Daly reflected on Campbell's selection by writing in the journal Pioneer that Prince Edward Island's new Liberal leader now has upon his shoulders one of the toughest political jobs ever undertaken in this province.
Re-energizing the party.
Campbell got right to work, laying down the track for a provincial election campaign that was sure to come in 1966. The party apparatus was thin. Having been out of power for 7 years, the Liberals had little money. The party headquarters had been at Alex Matheson's law office. Beyond rebuilding the party, Campbell realized that relationships with Ottawa would be essential. On the day of the convention, he spoke to John Mullally, who had served as a young member of Parliament for King's County for 2 years and was still licking his wounds after losing by 40 votes in the November 1965 federal election. Mullally had voted for Lorne Bunnell for the leadership out of King's County loyalty, but he was impressed by Campbell. As far as Campbell was concerned, the leadership race was over and it was time to build the team, in the province and beyond. Mullally was traveling to Moncton the following day to catch the train to return to Ottawa, where he was clearing out his office. Campbell offered to drive Mullally to Borden, and during the trip spoke to him about the Ottawa scene and about how Mullally could be helpful. Campbell's efforts would be assisted by a number of prominent Liberals from outside the province. George McElraith, who was Federal Minister of Public Works and Government House Leader, would hire John Mullally as a special assistant. He told him, "I want you to be of whatever assistance you can to Alex Campbell." Even though his only association with Prince Edward Island was what was known as the Causeway File, McElraith was one of a fraternity of senior party players who saw in Alex Campbell's leadership the possibility of shifting the island province to the Liberal win column. Two others who liked what they saw in Campbell were J. Edward Ned Beliveau and Charles McKelman, both of whom were wily and seasoned political organizers. Ned Beliveau was a Moncton native who, following a career as a political journalist, much of it with the Toronto Star, switched to full-time work as a political speechwriter and advisor and then to the advertising world. After a stint with the Ontario Liberal Party, he became closely associated with Lester Pearson. Much as was the case for Dalton Camp in conservative circles, Béliveau made it his business to lend assistance to provincial Liberal election campaigns, starting with Louis Robichaud in New Brunswick in 1960. McKelman had been a leading organizer for the New Brunswick Liberal Party from the early 1950s. He played a key role in Louis Robichaud's 1958 selection as party leader and became Robichaud's executive assistant after he was elected premier in 1960. While McKelman and Béliveau would later be labeled by some as Robichaud's raiders, they got involved with Campbell on their own initiative. Béliveau had his advertising business, and McKelman was appointed to the Senate in February of 1966. A third New Brunswicker, also a senator, became very helpful to the PEI Liberal efforts. Nelson Rattenbury grew up and did his early schooling in Charlottetown before his family moved to St. John, where he became involved in business and was famous for his political fundraising abilities, for which he was rewarded with a Senate appointment in 1964. From that vantage point, Rattenbury offered assistance to Sid Green, the lead fundraiser for Prince Edward Island Liberals. The PEI party had been run on a shoestring for years, and in early 1966 was close to broke financially. During the winter of 1966, Alex Campbell took part in more than 30 meetings with Liberal faithful and organizers throughout the province, with the aim of boosting both the organization and the spirits of the party. It was a good winter. Only one gathering had to be postponed due to the weather. He was joined at most of these meetings by party president W.R. Reg Jenkins and often by party organizer Sterling Lane and Frank Sigsworth, a young Charlottetown lawyer who acted as master of ceremonies. Campbell described Sigsworth as the most colorful speaker that one might find in the Atlantic provinces, with the possible exception of Joey Smallwood. Campbell himself was neither lively nor at ease on the platform. Following a meeting with about 75 people in Morrell, an older gentleman named McGuire came forward to tell him, "You're going to have to get more fire into your speeches." Campbell found the party demoralized. A lot of poll workers had dropped out through lack of interest or because they lacked access to patronage. The party had no policy-making apparatus. Starting out, the predominantly male audiences were not large and had an average age of 50 or 55. They were probably more interested in hearing their leader raise hell with the governing Tories than in building a policy platform. Over the course of the winter, the engagement level grew, along with a budding optimism that it might be possible to win the coming election. A major task for the winter of 1966 was to work with constituency organizations to identify prospective candidates. Given Premier Shaw's track record of calling an election after 3 years, an election could come at any time. With 13 sitting members, of whom two were retiring, there were 21 openings to fill. The Liberals attracted both new and experienced candidates, including former cabinet ministers Keir Clark and Eugene Cullen, Summerside accountant T. Earl Hickey, college registrar Gordon L. Bennett, and young lawyer J. Elmer Blanchard, who had run unsuccessfully in 1962. Frank Sigsworth and young farmer Don Anderson were nominated in the conservative stronghold of Second Kings, and the party had its first ever women candidates in Jean Canfield and Jean MacDonald, both going up against well-entrenched conservative incumbents. By the time the election was called, the party had a full cast of candidates. The spring session of the legislature was testy. The Liberals pounded on the province's financial situation and on concerns about economic development investments, notably in what was known as Georgetown Industries, a combined shipbuilding and food processing operation that would result in multi-million dollar losses for the PEI government. In the winter of 1966, information about Georgetown Industries was fragmentary. Heated exchanges in the legislature culminated in Conservative Cabinet Minister Leo Rossiter bringing a wheelbarrow full of industrial development records onto the floor of the House in response to opposition questions. The Shaw government had internal issues, underscored by the quiet resignation of businessman J. David Stewart from Cabinet the previous year. From an electoral point of view, the leading development during the session was the amendment of the Election Act to restore the geographically quirky 5th Kings District, thereby increasing the legislature to 32 seats. The session ended on April 8th without a much-anticipated election call, with Premier Shaw commenting in Delphic fashion, "We'll all be back again next year." In an April 16th televised address, the Premier announced that there would be an election on May 30th.
The campaign.
The Liberals were upbeat going into the election with their new leader, but they had no reason to be overconfident. Premier Shaw was a formidable figure, vital for his 78 years, and a capable performer. The Liberals made a deliberate decision not to question the Premier's age, for fear of alienating older voters or the large part of the general population who, whatever concerns they had about the province's direction, viewed Shaw with respect and affection. Moreover, while the Liberals had an underlying promise of youth and renewal on their side in Alex Campbell's leadership, they knew that the youth factor could backfire if they overplayed that hand. Ned Béliveau prepared a 7-page election strategy. In it, he cautioned that while it is generally true that old governments are voted out rather than new ones voted in, the ambitious opposition has to be able to show itself capable and responsible to take over and prove that it has the leadership to do it. Béliveau emphasized that, more than anything else, it is the leader who makes the difference. This emphasis on the leader, together with the centralization of electoral strategy and communications, marked an evolution in PEI politics. At the same time, the strategy urged candidates and workers to do everything in their power at the district and poll-by-poll level. If anything, the 1966 election saw a greater emphasis on door-to-door canvassing than had previously been employed in PEI, helped by the fact that this was the first May campaign since 1955. John Mullally, who moved from Ottawa when the vote was called, would remember almost 50 years later, "It was a grand month to have an election on Prince Edward Island." The Liberals adopted the slogan, "Let's go for action now." After the election was called, Alex Campbell spent a day huddled with Senator Charles McKelmon, working up a 12-point platform that reflected a want list of initiatives discussed at meetings during the winter. The program was presented to the party's candidates and lead organizers later that day at the Kirkwood Motel and then unveiled by Campbell in a province-wide television address. The promises that attracted the most attention offered funding for school books up to grade 10 and increased pensions for seniors. In addition, there would be action for agriculture, improved and expanded fisheries, a 5-year road-building program, industrial development, and sound and efficient government. The 12-point program even mentioned the causeway as an assumption under promised investments in tourism, golf courses, and parks. On May 19th, the Federal Department of Public Works issued a tender call for the second stage of the Causeway project. However, it still didn't become a campaign issue to the benefit of either side.
Good evening. This evening, I have the privilege of officially opening the election campaign on behalf of the Liberal Party in Prince Edward Island, and I will be announcing the highlights of the Liberal platform upon which our 32 candidates will seek your confidence and support at the polling booths on May the 30th. This now is the keynote occasion in our campaign. This is the time when I, as leader, am charged by my party and my supporting Liberal candidates to lay before you our platform on which we are fully confident our island economy can be set in motion, in which greater opportunities can be brought within the grasp of every islander. Our program is designed to create increased productivity in farming, fishing, island industry, and among our laboring people, to inspire greater hope and opportunity for our youth, and provide a greater source of security for our senior citizens.
Taken as a whole, the Liberal platform lacked sizzle and did not differ dramatically from what the Conservatives were promising. The Conservatives proposed a major thrust in economic development under the slogan, "Building an Island of Opportunity." This included the ambitious claim that the island's total economy would triple over the next 5 years, with a 5-fold increase as a long-range objective. This would be accomplished through one of the biggest projects ever undertaken anywhere in Canada. However, the details turned out to be a familiar laundry list of promises. Neither party proposed tax increases. The closest they came to an argument about policy positions was a dispute over who was offering the most to pensioners and whether the Conservatives had stolen the Liberal promise. The Liberals downplayed criticism of the investments in Georgetown during the campaign, in part because they didn't have a firm handle on the facts of the situation, but also because they didn't want to alienate voters in Fifth Kings and neighboring districts. They promised that industrial development funds would be more equitably deployed throughout the province, including support for traditional sectors. The main thing to be discerned from comparing the party platforms was that it was a close election, perhaps even closer than normal on Prince Edward Island. The greatest contrast between the parties in the 1966 election was not in their policies, but in their campaign styles and effectiveness. This showed most in their use of the media. On May 11th, the day following the televised unveiling of the Liberal program, full-page advertisements appeared in island newspapers listing the 12 policy points. The ads featured a full-length photo of a young and confident Alex Campbell striding forward, almost as if he were going to step out of the newspaper into the reader's kitchen or living room, with the caption, "Promote an energetic island." This was a new approach to print advertising on Prince Edward Island and was the work of Ned Beliveau, assisted by island native David Anderson, who came in from Toronto to work on communications. Charles McKelman brought in Wendell Fulton, who had a background with the CBC and had recently become chief organizer of the New Brunswick Liberal Party, to work on radio and television advertising. Fortunately for the PEI Liberals, there were no elections elsewhere in the Maritimes in 1966, nor was there a federal election. With Wendell Fulton's guidance, the Liberal Party purchased 60 one-minute television slots. Some party organizers wanted to use these TV slots for speeches, but Fulton and Ned Beliveau prevailed. The priority was to show Alex Campbell with the people. They produced 10 videos on selected themes, mainly showing Alex Campbell in different parts of Prince Edward Island, starting in his home in Summerside with his young family. One video showed Campbell with fish plant workers and lobster fishermen at the Tignish Run. Another showed him at the racetrack, with the folksy line, "He even takes time for the horses." The ads were popular, not least because it was the first opportunity for many Prince Edward Islanders to see parts of their own province on television. In the late stages of the campaign, the Conservatives realized the effectiveness of the television ads and rushed to prepare their own, but they were of inferior quality. Wendell Fulton recalls that one Conservative ad showed an image of an industrial plant with Walter Shaw's voice booming in the background. The Prince Edward Island model of one-minute videos was subsequently adopted elsewhere, including in the 1967 New Brunswick election campaign. The innovations of the 1966 PEI campaign came at a time of growing consciousness about the impact and potential of electronic media, especially by those who were following Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media. Along with the technological benefits of mass communication, the 1966 campaign saw a shift in the whole approach to political messaging. Ned Beliveau prepared a smartly written document titled Hints to Campaign Workers and Candidates. Whereas the strongest ratings in earlier elections were likely to go to those who whipped up their own team and successfully denigrated the other side with colorful language and a sharp wit, Beliveau cautioned, "The television audience is everybody.
It is a man and wife in a parlor with two beers. It is an old lady in a nightcap thinking about her night prayers. It is a juvenile twister trying to keep still long enough to get a turn at the telephone to call his girl. It is the student of politics, the fisherman, the farmer, the lawyer, the businessman. It is also the liberal and the Tory and a few socialists as individuals. Therefore, you cannot talk to a television or radio audience as if it were a solid crowd of liberals in the church hall back home. You can't attack these TV and radio strangers because they voted wrong the last time, nor should anyone ever make personal attacks through these media because they will rebound and knock you down."
The 60 television ads cost a total of $3,600, or $60 apiece. John Mullally ran the central office without worrying about funding. That was Sid Green's job. Given that the Liberals had been out of power for 7 years, raising the funds to mount an effective election campaign was a serious challenge. In those days, the biggest contributions came from firms doing business with government, notably in liquor and construction. These corporate donors were less inclined to give to the opposition party unless it was near certain that there would be a change of government. Fortunately, there were generous individuals, including some who, while firmly partisan, gave financially to both sides to support the two-party system. Senator Nelson Rattenbury was helpful with connections and advice. Critically, Rattenbury provided or arranged for a loan, which Wendell Fulton recalls as being $50,000, to be repaid through post-election fundraising. Whatever the innovations in the use of the mass media, the predominant activity of the 1966 campaign consisted of meeting the people, on the doorstep, in farmyards and on wharves, on street corners and in coffee shops. Campbell campaigned door-to-door with candidates in each of the 16 ridings. He was his own chauffeur and often stayed overnight at the home of the local candidate to ensure an early morning start. He was at his best one-on-one. Even by comparison with Walter Shaw, who was notorious for his affability, Campbell was well received. He remembered names. He asked questions and listened. John Mullally says of Campbell, he had a unique ability to get along with people on the wharf or on the firm and with the top of the order. There was no puffery. He could change his feathers. He could absorb the personalities, the mood, and the issues. Although she had plenty to do at home, Marilyn Campbell appeared at campaign events and was an asset to the Liberal cause. She was alongside Alex at many of his rallies and appeared as the guest of honor at ladies' afternoon teas. The teas were an acknowledgement of the power of the women's vote and of Marilyn Campbell's ability to attract voters to the Liberal side. They retained heavy traces of convention and what, from today's perspective, would be considered sexism. Marilyn was accompanied by a team of social aides. Newspaper reports identified the convener and the ladies who poured tea. It was something of a breakthrough for the women, at least the women of a younger age, to be referred to by their own first or given names rather than their husband's name. That is to say, to be known as Marilyn Campbell rather than Mrs. Alex Campbell. Nonetheless, it was the men, usually the local candidates, who did most of the speaking. At a May 26th afternoon tea in Second Kings, candidates Don Anderson and Frank Sigsworth spoke, with Sigsworth offering the following words of welcome. Marilyn Campbell's presence with us this afternoon provides us all with delightful assurance that in the wife of our new Liberal Premier, our island province will be a further source of envy to other provinces in the charm and friendly dignity of its Chatelaine-elect. Beyond appearing at afternoon teas and public meetings, Marilyn Campbell did not get involved in campaigning, saying, "It was just something that I wouldn't do." The stock in trade of the 1966 campaign remained the political rally. These were meetings designed to encourage the troops and build enthusiasm, more so than to win converts. They also provided a useful platform for statements aimed at media coverage. Campbell took part in 14 rallies and numerous other meetings throughout the province, beginning with a kickoff event in Murray River and concluding with what was billed as a giant rally at the Kennedy Coliseum in Charlottetown 3 days before the election. The final giant rally featured Don Messer and the Islanders, along with the Book to Dancers, to warm up the crowd of 1,200 partisans.
Election Day.
As May 30th approached, the consensus seemed to be that the election had been a dull affair. On the Saturday before the election, the Guardian editorial observed that the campaign had been conducted on a reasonably high level, notably in contrast to what the Guardian called the stormy manner of the spring legislative sitting. The journal Pioneer declared the campaign the quietest in years, with both parties coming up with similar pledges. In a reflection on the campaign, the journal Pioneer editors had this assessment.
The Liberals, we thought, waged a smart campaign and kept it on a very high plane. There was an absolute minimum of mudslinging on both sides. They played up the image of their dynamic, young, and personable leader, and they came up with certain platform promises which obviously appealed to the electorate, and they hammered them home in all their publicity. The Conservative platform didn't seem to be as clear and as concise, and in the end, they had to adopt one or more of the Liberal planks. They had a record of considerable achievement to point to, but the voters didn't seem to be listening.
Given PEI's tight two-party traditions and the intensive on-the-ground campaign, it was no surprise that the result remained up in the air until late in the evening of May 30th. In fact, the outcome would not be determined until July 11th. 5 days before the election, First King's Liberal candidate William Acorn passed away suddenly. This meant that there would be a deferred election in that district. For the remaining 30 seats, the election day result was 16 Liberals and 14 Progressive Conservatives. This was a tight outcome, even by PEI standards. In 15 of the 30 contests, the margin was less than 200 votes. Three seats turned on leads of five or fewer votes. A lot would depend on recounts. Newspaper accounts spoke of a cliffhanger and a teetering margin. Both Alex Campbell and Premier Shaw were circumspect in their comments. Shaw expressed disappointment at the defeat of four cabinet ministers and commented that he would have preferred a more decisive outcome. Campbell said he was pleased by the strong party showing and the net gain of three seats, but cautioned that the election remained definitely in doubt. When asked by journalists about the possibility of a coalition, Shaw responded, "I'm too independent for that." Campbell said, "I don't think the coalition party ran in this election, did it?" Alex Campbell won his fifth Prince seat by a healthy margin of 263 votes, despite having spent most of the campaign away from his district.
If it moves, give it a pension. If it doesn't move, pave it.
When the official balloting results were confirmed 1 week later, Conservative Cabinet Minister Lloyd MacPhail moved from the loss to the win column. This meant that the Liberals and Conservatives were deadlocked at 15-15 and that the First King's deferred election would now be determinative. The Liberals nominated businessman and former Surrey Mayor Bruce Stewart to join sitting MLA Dan MacDonald. This was generally conceded to be a strong ticket. The Conservatives put forward a competitive team in Chepstow farmer Peter McCauley and Surrey car dealer Keith McKenzie. Both parties poured every resource at their disposal into the district. In an unorthodox move, Progressive Conservative candidate Keith McKenzie was named Minister of Highways. Paving and construction equipment appeared throughout the riding. Even private driveways and municipal streets were paved by the provincial government. Premier Shaw announced an increase in the provincial minimum wage, as well as a $25 pension supplement retroactive to April 1st. When it appeared that the federal government might not be able to provide mailing lists of pensioners in time to have checks delivered before July 11th, Minister of Health Dr. Hubert McNeill, who had been defeated in the general election, mused about setting up emergency centres, notably in Surrey, so that seniors could register to receive their supplemental checks. This gave rise to a quip about the First King's campaign. If it moves, give it a pension. If it doesn't move, pave it. The Conservatives promised seniors and family housing units, assistance to local fire departments, a new national park in Eastern Kings, and other goodies. Without access to the levers of government, the Liberals were at a perceived disadvantage when it came to offering patronage. The biggest prize became a vacant Senate seat. Some Liberals in First Kings, including Dan MacDonald, felt that it would help the campaign if former Kings MP Tom Kickham were appointed and an active lobby was mounted on his behalf. Prime Minister Pearson was sternly opposed to appointing Kickham because he had allegedly gotten drunk at a United Nations conference in the 1950s while Pearson was Under Secretary for External Affairs. Ned Beliveau reported that a Pearson aide had quoted his boss as saying that Kickham would get the appointment over my dead body. Alex Campbell persisted in urging the Prime Minister to appoint Kickham and even sent Sid Green to Ottawa to plead the case. On the final Friday before the election, John Mullally was in the Surrey campaign office when the phone rang. It was Jack Pickerskill, the powerful regional cabinet minister, calling to speak with Campbell on behalf of Prime Minister Pearson. Campbell was at the barber shop. Pickerskill asked Mullally how important the Kickham appointment was to the election outcome. Mullally said he was sure the party would appreciate it, notably that it would show that the federal government was responsive to Campbell. Pickerskill confirmed that the appointment would be made that day, and Campbell announced it the following evening to a cheering crowd at the wrap-up rally at Surrey High School. When asked almost 50 years later whether the Kickham Senate appointment was really that consequential, John Mullally admitted that by the Saturday prior to the vote, it was a non-factor, except for perhaps a few people in Little Pond. The effort that went into lobbying for the Senate appointment typifies the First King's deferred election. Nothing was taken for granted. Everything was considered to be at stake. Every home was visited at least once. With fewer than 2,500 voters, every family and every individual voter was treated as if they would determine the next provincial government. Alex Campbell moved to the district for the duration of the campaign, living at Bruce Stewart's cottage at Red Point. He pushed himself so hard that he developed a severe eczema rash on his hands, although few people knew about it and he never missed an opportunity to shake the hand of a voter, however painful. All four candidates canvassed relentlessly, as did their families and every available party foot soldier, including people from outside the district who thought they might be helpful. There was a deluge of print and broadcast advertising, even through the Sydney, Nova Scotia television station. In Eastern Kings, the quality of television reception from Cape Breton was better than from Charlottetown. The Charlottetown newspapers reverted to their partisan stripes of old, especially in editorials, with The Guardian bending over backwards to favour the Conservatives and The Evening Patriot boosting the Liberals. There were charges and countercharges of vandalism and dirty tricks. Reports circulated of previously unheard-of levels of bribes or booze offered in exchange for votes, although there were still complaints that the rum being proffered, while generous in quantity, was rot-gut. Late in the final week of the campaign, Campbell flew to Sydney, Nova Scotia to record a message to be broadcast via the Cape Breton television station to the voters of First Kings on the Friday prior to the election.
This evening, I am addressing myself directly to the voters of First Kings District in Prince Edward Island. You are the people who, on Monday next, will decide whether Prince Edward Island is to have a new government. You voters, you Prince Edward Islanders who live near the eastern tip of the island, will have the opportunity of completing the swing towards liberalism started on May 30th. Therefore, next Monday, July the 11th, is a red-letter day in the history of our island. On that day, you alone can elect a new and vigorous government for all of Prince Edward Island. A new government will be chosen only if both Dan MacDonald and Bruce Stewart are elected. It takes your votes for both, and there is a separate ballot for Mr. MacDonald and a separate one for Mr. Stewart. When you go to your poll on Monday, you personally will say what kind of government PEI is to have for the next 4 or 5 years. You will say by your own vote what you want done and what kind of future you want for your family, your district, and for all of Prince Edward Island. Never in the history has one district had the great privilege and distinction of making such a decision. It is a great responsibility and a great opportunity.
On election day, CBC journalist Kingsley Brown of the television program News Magazine questioned Alex Campbell about vote buying, suggesting that there were reports of bribes of as much as $50 or $100. Campbell answered the question directly while astutely avoiding trouble. "I anticipate that this is going on, Kingsley, to be perfectly honest with you. As much as I personally, as well as the Liberal Party and no doubt the Conservative Party, hate this business, I feel you've got to start eliminating the problem by putting teeth into the Election Act." As the interview was taking place on Surrey's Main Street, Walter Shaw drove by at the wheel of his full-size sedan. Campbell interrupted the interview for some good-natured banter with Shaw, asking, "Are you as confident as we are, sir?" Shaw responded, "I am at the apex of my confidence." When the votes were counted, Dan MacDonald had a majority of 207 votes and Bruce Stewart 158. 91% of eligible voters cast ballots. These were unusually high margins in First Kings, and a slightly higher than normal voter turnout. There were celebrations late into the night on the streets of Surrey. Conservative Cabinet Minister Leo Rossiter, who had spent the day ferrying voters to the polls in his Ford Galaxy, turned to his son Eugene as they watched the results in Elmira to say, "I guess we drove a lot of grits to the polls today." For both sides, there were essential lessons, which were often vainly ignored about Prince Edward Island politics. First, you can't buy votes, and second, when the tide turns, there's no stopping it. Alex Campbell was gracious in victory, expressing his great joy and his sense of tremendous responsibility at the outcome. Walter Shaw said that while his immediate reaction was one of disappointment, he acknowledged that the people have spoken and said that he looked forward to getting down to sincere business and cooperation in the legislature.
The Ascent at the Crest.
By the time the First King's deferred election was over on July 11th, Prince Edward Island had been in full-scale election mode for 86 days. Alex Campbell had been actively on the hustings for almost 9 months, since agreeing in the fall of 1965 to become a candidate for the Liberal Party leadership. Prince Edward Islanders had been given an extended opportunity to get to know Campbell, and he to know them. Whereas many people identified him as Thane Campbell's son when he sought the leadership, he was now Alex, or Alec, the more common pronunciation, to large numbers of Islanders. They had come to know Campbell to be smart, dynamic, and personable. These were all qualities that he would require as the 21st Premier of Prince Edward Island.